This is Ancient Israel, Lecture Number 3, Archaeology, Chronology. Today we're going to continue with this three-lecture series on archaeology. As I pointed out before, we can't exhaust the topic. It's far too big for that. But we need to get at least a basic familiarity with it and how it has been used in the field of biblical studies and in reconstructing the history of ancient Israel. Last time, we went over the methods. I gave you a procedural definition for archaeology. We saw that when it comes to the systematic recovery of the ancient remains, that is done in a very scientific way. The analysis is done in a very scientific way. They measure, they draw very accurately the things that they find. But that when it comes to interpretation, that's where the element of art involved in archaeology comes into full play. And while at times it is very simple to be certain of your conclusions that you're drawing, as in the case of that oven on the mosaic floor, very evident from that, that which one was put down first, that sometimes archaeological conclusions are more subjective. And we saw in the case particularly of the matter of the opus reticulum style of brickwork at Herod's palace near Jericho, that since this is a style unique to Italy, we cannot be certain if there were Jewish craftsmen sent from Palestine to Italy to learn it and then coming back to do the work, or Herod imported Italian craftsmen, or even a third possibility, they were neither Jews nor Italians, but some other origin who learned that work somewhere else and were employed by Herod. So we have no way of pinning those types of things down. And it's in the area of interpretation where archaeology is most vulnerable to criticism. And what I asked you to do was to read an article for today, in preparation for today's class, entitled The Importance of Dating by Paul Lapp. And reviewing once again about Paul Lapp, he is no longer alive, but he, until his death, he served as the director of the American School of Oriental Research in Jerusalem, which is the most prestigious organization involved in archaeology in the Holy Land. I think we should therefore give a lot of attention to what he says about a very important area dealing with archaeology, and that is chronological dating. Because coming up with these ancient remains is rather meaningless unless you can put it into some type of a time framework. You have to be able to locate it in time if it's really to be of any real use to the historian. Now, in his article, he makes a distinction between two types of chronological dating. One is called relative dating, and the other is absolute dating. Now, relative dating is a very imprecise type of chronological dating. That means all you can say about two objects that you found is A is older than B. That's all you can say about it. You have no idea of how much older. You have no idea of when either was used, but it's simply a matter of one being certainly older than the other. Now, if we didn't have other information, if you didn't know, remember that slide again where I showed you the mosaic floor and the oven that was built across the corner of it? That's very clear which is first and which is second. We know that the mosaic floor is older than the oven. But if you didn't know where that mosaic floor and oven were located, you would be able to make no other conclusion that the mosaic floor is older than the oven. That's as far as you could go. It's because of other data that we can then turn that relative dating sequence into a fairly accurate absolute dating. For instance, that floor occurs in a building at Masada, in one of the buildings that Herod the Great had built as part of his palace complex up there at the top of Masada. Now, we know from other records when Herod built the fortress at Masada. That gives us a very good absolute date within a few years of when that mosaic floor was laid down. Now, what about the oven? Well, we know that the zealots who held out against the Romans and committed mass suicide there before being captured by the Romans in 73 A.D. They occupied that building around 70 A.D., and they lived there from 70 to 73. So that oven had to have been built on that mosaic floor between 70 A.D. and 73. So you see, it's not the thing itself that we can give an absolute date. There's no intrinsic characteristic of the thing that gives it a date. It's other information that we can relate to these finds that enables us to give it a date and turn it from a relative date into an absolute one. Now, how precise are absolute dates? You may read an article on archaeology and they'll say, this level of this particular city is dated to the 9th century B.C. Or they might even say circa 854 B.C. How seriously should you take such claims when you read them in either a popular journal or if some of you were to dig into some more specialized journals like the Biblical Archaeologist, how seriously should you take such things? Well, Dr. Lapp addresses that question on page 1 of the article, which is numbered since it started on page 13 in this journal. It's page 13 on the handout. On the right-hand column, you have a very small one-sentence paragraph. Is archaeology able to provide datings precise enough to be of historical value? That's a good question. And notice his answer. Scholars disagree on an answer to this question. Sober replies vary from sometimes to almost never. In other words, in answering the question, is archaeology able to give datings precise enough to be of historical value? Many scholars will say, sometimes. And some scholars will say, almost never. What's missing from the range of answers is, most often. Or always. Nobody says that. None of the scholars say always. None of the scholars say almost always or most often. The scholars would say either sometimes at best or almost never. Notice, as he continues this particular thing, that one competent, that's a key word, scholar, concludes that the evidence points to an identification of certain ruins with Saul's fortress as the best hypothesis. They found some ruins at Givat Shaul, Geba of Benjamin, where Saul had his capital. And they say, this must be the remains of Saul's fortress. Well, that's one competent scholar's idea, but notice that's his best hypothesis. You see, that's not a fact. Another insists that the evidence is too meager to justify such a postulation. Such positions tend to become overpolarized when the weaknesses and tentativeness of the best hypothesis are not emphasized. You see, the scholar may present all the evidence for his dating, you know, that supports it very prominently, but never say a word about the drawbacks in the evidence or the weaknesses. And you're only reading what he wants you to read. And so you think, oh, this is certain. This has got to be true. Well, he's hiding some of the things that weaken his best hypothesis. Notice what it says. Not only will such positions become overpolarized when weaknesses and tentativeness of the best hypothesis are not emphasized, or, this is even worse, when the best hypothesis is ignored as one among several interpretive options. Maybe there were several possible interpretations, and the best one was one he didn't like. Didn't fit in with his preconceived ideas. He shoves that aside, and he gives you something that's weaker and says, this is it. Without access to all the information, you don't know that. You see, you have to put a lot of faith in the integrity of the writer. And therefore, we have to keep this in mind. People do these things, even if they be called scholars. And I'll talk a little later when we talk in the area about problems next time in archaeology as to why scholars do these things. Okay, notice what Lapp himself says in answer to the question. And remember, this is a very experienced authority in the field who is writing to us, or was writing to us. Notice the interesting choice of words he uses in the next paragraph. I tend to feel. not I do feel, I tend to feel that archaeological material is sometimes susceptible of sufficient chronological precision to be of historical importance. Now talk about a qualified statement. That's a beaut. But you see, he's trying to do the thing honestly. He's trying to say it the way it is. And that's why when you read, you have to watch for these qualifications. Don't skip over them. They're very important. Now notice what he says after that. He says, after all, the evidence of ancient history is so limited. In fact, we estimate that we may have 1/1,000th of all the evidence that was originally available that has survived to our day. And we're trying to draw conclusions about what happened and why it happened and when it happened based on only 1/1,000th of all the evidence that ever existed. You know, we could be way off base because we're working with such a limited amount of material. He says, after all, the evidence of ancient history is so limited that very few statements approach the indubitable. I mean, indubitable means things that cannot be questioned or doubted. To illustrate, Ahab was killed in a battle near Ramoth-Gilead about 850 B.C. The probable site of Ramoth-Gilead suffered a major destruction about the middle of the 9th century B.C., which is 850. So we know Ahab was killed about 850 near Ramoth-Gilead, or rather was wounded seriously enough that they carried him back home and he died. And we know the site of Ramoth-Gilead was destroyed about 850. Those are two known facts. What would then be the most reasonable conclusion? Ahab is mortally wounded in a battle at Ramoth-Gilead at around 850. The city is destroyed about 850. Seems reasonably logical. We should link the two things together and say that after Ahab lost the battle, his enemies destroyed the city. But you can't prove it. There's nothing in the destruction of Ramoth-Gilead at that level that proves absolutely the Syrians of Damascus who had defeated Ahab were responsible for the destruction. It's just the most likely conclusion among others. But as he says, the destruction could have occurred a few years before Ahab's death when a cow kicked over a lamp, or a few years after when an enemy set his neighbor's grain heap ablaze and then the fire got out of control and destroyed the whole town. It could be, but it's not as likely, you see. So we deal with probabilities when we assign causes to destruction levels of different sites. And that's something we have to keep in mind when we get down later in the semester to the matter of the Israelite conquest and sifting through the archaeological evidence in Palestine, looking for the evidence of Joshua's conquest, is that we're dealing with probabilities. This is Joshua's work. Probability, this is not Joshua's work. And we'll see that that's itself a problem in that area. When we get to that point, you'll understand that more clearly. Okay. He says at the beginning of the next paragraph, at the very bottom of page 13, where is the line to be drawn between such hypotheses, as he just mentioned about the cow kicking over the lamp, or the neighbor setting his grain heap ablaze, and the objectionable practice of over-correlation of biblical and archaeological material? It takes well-balanced judgment to draw that line appropriately. And this is the kicker. No two historians would draw it at exactly the same point. You see how subjective this business is? Even the matter of assigning dates. Very, very subjective. Okay, we now know how subjective it is in assigning dates. How close can an archaeologist come to the true date when he does assign a date? This is a very revealing statement. We find it here on page 14 in that top paragraph. It is now frequently possible. Did he say always possible? No. Frequently possible. To date archaeological groups within a quarter or half century. In other words, to give a date which is within 25 to 50 years of its real date. It is frequently possible. Notice what he says, though. Correlations with such material are certainly more convincing than material which is dated no more closely than within a century or two, as is the case with the vast majority of archaeological finds in Palestine to date. So if you say normally or usually or most frequently, how close can the archaeologist be sure of coming to the real date when he gives a date? What's the answer? Most often it's within 100 to 200 years. He'll admit he's off maybe as somewhere between 100 and 200 years. That's most often the case. Though, at frequently, he can get within 25 or 50 years. So we have to remember that if we, based upon the Bible being an accurate historical record, feel that some material should be given a date of, let's say, 1400 B.C., and archaeologists who do not accept the authenticity of the Bible say, no, no, that material is 1550 B.C., 150 years earlier. We're still well within that range of probable disagreement in many cases. It's only 150 years off the two ideas, well within that 100 to 200 year period area of error, which is quite likely to happen in the majority of cases. Okay. There is a lot of other very rich material in this article, but I don't want to go over all of it. Let's take up the matter of what could be used to date archaeological material. What ways are available or tools are available to the archaeologists? A lot of people have heard about radiocarbon dating and say, oh, I guess the archaeologists use that very heavily. This slide that we have on the screen shows you the principle upon which radiocarbon dating is based. And that is, as things live, they are constantly combining carbon-14 as well as the more common carbon-12 with oxygen to form carbon dioxide. Now, plants take this into their systems. It becomes part of the material of the plant as their the stuff of which a plant is composed. When a plant is eaten by an animal, it then becomes part of the animal system. Or if a human being eats the plant, it becomes part of his system. Or if we eat, as you see on the slide, the animal, it eventually becomes part of ours. Now, we're always taking in this carbon. And there's a certain ratio. Carbon 12 is the more common form. Carbon 14 is a variation of the more common carbon atom. It has a slightly higher atomic weight. That's why we call it carbon 14. There's a certain ratio that exists. Most of the carbon in our bodies is the more common carbon 12. We have a certain amount of the carbon 14. Now, when a living thing dies, you don't take in any more carbon. And what's there in the carbon 14, which is an unstable form of the carbon, begins to deteriorate. It begins to disappear. Because this is an unstable version of the carbon. Therefore, if there is a certain ratio there at the time of the living thing's death, the ratio will be different after, as time goes by. The longer time goes by, the less carbon 14 will be left, because it's always disintegrating. So what the scientists do, if they have a piece of wood or a piece of bone, it has to be a piece of organic material, they analyze how much carbon 12 is in it, how much carbon 14 is in it. And the smaller the amount of carbon 14, the older it is, because it has been deteriorating all that time. And so they arrive at a date based on this procedure. Now, how often do archaeologists use this? Well, in the period we're mainly interested in, from the time of Abraham on, they don't rely on it very heavily. because carbon-14 dates have a margin of error on either side of the assigned date. For example, if we took a piece of bone and had it dated by carbon-14, it might yield a date of 1720 BC with a margin of error of plus or minus 175 years. Now, what does that mean if the margin of error is 175 years and you get a date of 1720? It means it could be 175 years before 1720. It could be 175 years after 1720. There's that much of a margin of error. So if we take away 175 years from 1720, if I do my math right, I should arrive at a date of 1545 BC. And if I add 175 years to the 1720, I'll end up with 1895 BC. So the real date of this object could be anywhere between 1895 BC and 1545 BC. That's a pretty wide range. It's not enough precision to be of value to an historian. Imagine having a document, a letter. Now let's see, does this letter date from the time of George Washington or Jimmy Carter? Well, let's subject it to carbon-14 analysis, you see. Well, the results come back. It could be anywhere from the time of Washington to Jimmy Carter. You know, it's useless. It doesn't solve the point we're interested in knowing. So carbon-14 dating is not that much used by archaeologists who are interested in the biblical history. And in fact, the further back in time you go, the wider the margin of error, possible error. Around 3000 BC, it could be plus or minus 250 years. That's a 500-year span. That somewhere in there is the real date. That's much too loose. So radiocarbon dating is not used by archaeologists who are interested in the biblical period from Abraham to the captivity. Well, the most accurate form of dating is by using inscriptions. Whoops, I went too far. I'll just leave this here. Oops. Okay. Inscriptions. Because documents or inscriptions frequently give something in them that can be used to give an absolute date. It may say the 20th year of King so-and-so. And if you're able to establish the reigning dates of that king, you can find very precisely what date you're talking about. But inscriptions or documents, while they find loads of them in Egypt and quite a lot in Greece, we cannot find very many in Palestine. We have not found many in Palestine. The reason is that most of the documents that were written in Palestine were written on papyrus. Papyrus is very perishable in the climate of Palestine, except in the very dry areas, near the Dead Sea, perhaps, or in the far south. And there, not so much papyrus, but parchment has survived for thousands of years. But documents written on papyrus are very perishable, and we have, therefore, very few inscriptions from Palestine. And most of those are written either on clay tablets, as was the method in Mesopotamia, or they're written on potsherds, little broken pieces of pottery. So we can rarely use inscriptions to date archaeological material in Palestine. Now, in the article, he discusses a number of different objects that could be used. He notices that coins, people usually think about coins. Oh, they always show the year of the king in which it was minted. You know, wouldn't that be wonderful? Two big problems with coins. What are they? Mr. Murray?
Didn't go back that far.
Right. Coins don't go back that far. Coins only began to be used in the area of Palestine as in around the 6th or 5th century. 5th century, more commonly, B.C. Before the 5th century B.C., you don't have coins in Palestine. So for most of the period we're interested in, there are no coins to be used for dating. But even where coins occur, why are they a poor tool to use for dating? Ben? That's right. They have an heirloom factor. People tend to save them for generations. Remember, coins were not made of the cheap stuff we have today. They were made of gold, very fine quality gold, or silver, being almost pure. They were the kinds of things people saved up for, quote, the proverbial rainy day, when their family might need emergency cash. They tended to be saved for generations. So if you find it at a certain level, that coin might be have been minted generations before it was finally dropped where you found it. Plus, there's another problem with coins. There's actually a third problem that makes it difficult to date a level based on the coin that's found in it. Julie? Right. Stratigraphic problems. Coins are so tiny, many of them, they can easily filter through from one level to another. And therefore, you can't be positive that the level in which you found it is the level in which it was dropped. So it's not a very good tool. The same problem occurs with jewelry. Jewelry, of course, goes back much further than coins. And styles did change with time. But the problem is that they also tended to be passed on from generation to generation. And so you have this heirloom factor, and so it's not very good. Archaeologists in Palestine, following the lead of Sir Flinders Petrie, who developed this in the case of Egypt, have decided that there is only one tool that really makes sense to use as a way to date, to give chronological dates to archaeological material in Canaan or in Palestine. And that's this stuff we see in the slide, pottery. Pottery, one of the most simple, unassuming, humble things that you can find in a dig, this is what is used as the major tool to give chronological dates to the different levels. And if any of you have worked on a dig, and I know a number of you in the class have, you know you find tons of it. I have a collection of napkin rings, which consists of jar handles from about 700 B.C. And we use them occasionally, you know, when we have company. And usually when our guests first see them, if they've never been on a dig, they look at that and they say, well, how old is this? And I say, oh, that one is about 8th century B.C., around 700 B.C., I would say, maybe 750 B.C. Ooh, and they hold it so gingerly, as if it's a very rare, precious thing, and I'd be so angry if they dropped and broke it. I mean, those things piled up by the dozens and dozens and dozens on the refuse heap at the dig. That's how I was permitted to take them away. You see, they're so common, you see. Potsherds are very, very common. But yet, this is one reason why it can serve as a dating tool. To serve as a dating tool, it has whatever you use has to have certain characteristics. Number one, those characteristics would be that you have to find a lot of it. Because let's say you only found one such example of this dating tool in any given layer. But what if you missed it in a layer? Well, then you couldn't date the layer. But if you've got plenty of it in every layer, you can't miss it. It's all over the place. You know, you just can't, no matter where you dig in that level, you're going to find pottery. So its abundance makes it valuable as a dating tool. That's one of its characteristics, which is very important. The second thing is pottery is found just about everywhere in the Middle East. I don't care what site you start to dig on. Unless it's a very, very ancient site, you're going to find pottery. Because if you're using one item as your tool to assign chronological dates everywhere in the Middle East, you have to be able to find it everywhere in the Middle East, not just at one or two places. And so the second characteristic is its widespread occurrence. Widespread occurrence. The third major characteristic, you can't use something to date the level if it's gone. Right? If it's deteriorated, if it's decomposed because of the way it was laid down or how long it's been in the earth. You need something which is practically indestructible. It's guaranteed to survive and be there. And pottery, of course, is indestructible. Once it's been baked, it can be broken, but it's still going to be there. And the last characteristic, which is important, is that it has to change its form frequently. If people made pottery like this jug, and they made it exactly the same way, with the same shape, the same decoration, for 500 years, how would you know where in that 500-year period to put this particular specimen? You wouldn't. But if, let's say, every 20 or 50 years, they change the decoration, changing the colors, changing the design, changing where they put the handle, maybe at the beginning they put the handle up near the top, and then about 25 years later they got tired of that, so they made the handle like this, and then they got tired of that, so they changed the handle and put it down around the neck, and then 25 years later they said, no, that's no good, we should put two handles, one over here and one over here. You see, the potters were always altering what they did with the same basic pot or plate, putting handles in different places, changing the shapes of them, changing the shape of the rim, changing the shape of the base, slenderizing it, changing the design. They're always fiddling with it. They get tired of the old styles. Yes?
Would the potters, the potter makers in the whole area, would they have that one design? Isn't there the variety? Since like we have all sorts of designs of cars.
Okay. It's a good question as to whether everybody would use the same design over the whole area. When we talk about the whole Middle East, of course not. But within a given region, it is common to find the same kind of pottery throughout the region. Now, I'm going to come to some basic assumptions that are made about pottery, which enable it to be used as a dating tool. And there is a certain weakness with this. And now I have a handout which shows you some of the characteristic pottery types of different chronological periods from the Chalcolithic to the Byzantine. So we'll just distribute these. You can just file them away, and this will give you an idea of the variations that have occurred from period to period. Now, they are able to use pottery as a chronological dating tool because, as I say, it changes its characteristics. Now, this particular slide shows you a collection of oil lamps. They come from different periods. Notice how different they are. Starting over on the left-hand side, you have a very simple kind where the area that held the wick was just made by pinching the clay to form a constriction. This dates from the 8th, 7th century B.C. These specimens that come next date from the Persian period. Then we have a very distinctive form, third from the right, with the very sharp edges around the area where the wick was placed, and an unornamented a central hole into which you poured the oil. This is the kind of lamp that was typically used at the time of Christ. Dates from what we call the Herodian period. Very distinctive form. The form which is second from the right is highly decorated. It dates from the Byzantine period. And the one way on the right, the largest of the oil lamps, dates from the early Arabic period. See, there are major differences in these oil lamps. And therefore, since one style is very, very typical and abundant in a given period, if you were digging in a dig site and you found one of these oil lamps, you could pretty much give it a date just based on the oil lamp. You wouldn't have to look too much at the other pottery. Because they do change very often. The styles change fairly frequently. Now, let's take a look at some of the assemblages. A pottery assemblage consists of plates, bowls, jugs, juglets, large storage vessels. This is an assemblage from a particular period. Note that there are some common characteristics in the different things. Many of the larger vessels have their handles where they join the main part of the vessel right at the rim of the vessel itself. We have three such examples. Then you have these pitchers that have sort of a rim around the neck of the vessel at the very point where the handle joins at the top. Now notice the next assemblage. You have some similarities in that the handle joins at the rim, but can you see what is present in a large number of these pitcher-like vessels which is absent from the previous group? What do you notice that's very different from the way they're treated? The ridges, the ribbing effect on these. Now, this ribbing effect is very typical of pottery from one particular period. Looking at the oil lamps, what period is it? Herodian, the time of Christ. With this ribbing effect, this is early Roman pottery, the early Roman period, or the Herodian period, the time of Christ. And we can see again that if we wanted to assign a date to this type of pottery, we just have to look at these oil lamps, and it gives us again an idea of when the rest of it should be dated. In other words, if all of these pots were found in the same level as these oil lamps, and we've already arrived at a date for the oil lamps, that immediately dates everything else that's found with it. You see, we now know that these types of pots are typical of the same period. And this is how they have elaborated the number of, or expanded is the word I want, the number of pots that are typical of a given period. Is by once they can date one particular kind, anything else found with it is from the same period, and therefore if they find later on not an oil lamp, but they find a juglet like this somewhere else, just by itself, they know to give it the same date. Now, I've touched upon two very important assumptions which are made in using pottery as an archaeological dating tool. And that is, one, that the same, as David mentioned earlier, the assumption is the same pottery is used everywhere in the region at the same time. There's no time lag, you see. You don't have a new style being introduced in Beersheba, and then 50 years later it starts to be produced in Jerusalem, and 50 years later it's being produced at Dan in the north. You see. We assume that if you find an oil lamp of one kind at Dan, and you find the same kind of oil lamp at Beersheba, they both come from the same period. You ignore what has to have been a time lag. Now, they assume you can ignore it because the time lag would not have been long. It wouldn't have taken 100 years for the style to travel. It might have taken 10 or 20. And after all, if you're trying to just date a level in its proper century or half century, what's the difference of 10 or 20 years? You're only interested in getting the date to within 50 years, so a lag of 20 years is not going to be important. You see, that's the assumption that the same pottery is used everywhere in the region, and we're talking about the Israel, we're talking from Dan to Beersheba. It's used everywhere between there, those two points, at the same time. Now, the second assumption is linked to the first. Pottery styles change simultaneously everywhere in the region. You don't have a gradual phasing out of one and an introduction of the other. In other words, you don't have any overlaps. Pottery A stops, pottery B begins, everywhere in the region at the same time. Now, that's a really hairy assumption, because obviously that couldn't happen. But again, what they're saying is, sure, there was overlap, but the overlap was probably only like 10 or 20 years, and so therefore we can ignore it. And I would say they are correct. If the assumption is it takes about 10 or 20 years for a new pottery type to begin to appear everywhere in the region, you can ignore the overlap in giving chronological dates. That's not going to be a serious problem. But the question is, are they correct in the two assumptions? Is the same pottery being used simultaneously in Dan as it is in Beersheba, the same basic kinds of pottery? And when they change in Dan, do they change very quickly to the same new pottery in Beersheba? Do they do that? Well, they assume they do. And all of the dates that you read about in books and articles dealing with dates of different levels in Palestine are based on these two assumptions. That this is what indeed happens. Now, this is something which often, I think, needs to be called into question, especially when dealing with the Israelite conquest. Especially when dealing with the Israelite conquest, this assumption must be called into question. And I will just very briefly show you an illustration of one time when it was shown quite convincingly that this assumption is not true uniformly, that it is not a valid assumption. They had a problem at one particular site, I'll use the English pronunciation, Lachish. The problem was this. They were interested in two particular levels. Level 2, as they called it, which suffered a massive destruction, and which was dated absolutely as belonging to the conquest of Nebuchadnezzar in 587 B.C. Now, how were they so positive? Because letters were found on potsherds describing Nebuchadnezzar's approach and the problems they were having. And it mentions, you know, the names of kings and so on, so we know it's 587 B.C. There's no question. The question was, when was the level beneath it, called level 3, when was that level destroyed? That was the question. Well, they naturally turned to the pottery. And they examined the pottery. And they came out with a conclusion which was very different from what the stratigraphy, the arrangement of the levels, would have suggested. The arrangement of the levels would have suggested this was the result of the destruction in 701 B.C. by Sennacherib. The Bible records that Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, came up at Lachish, did war against it, and destroyed it. This is the time of King Hezekiah. The arrangement of the levels in the tell would seem to suggest that that is the level Sennacherib destroyed. But what's the time difference between 587 and 701? It's pretty big, right? Okay. Somebody got a bright idea. They said, 701 B.C., that's only about 20 years after Samaria was destroyed by the Assyrians. Let's compare the pottery of this level 3 to the pottery of Samaria when it was destroyed by the Assyrians in 720. And you know what they found? Totally different kinds of pottery. They were not alike at all. The forms they found here at Lachish had evolved from the Sumerian types, but they were a long way down the pike in its evolution. Therefore, the conclusion, if it's derived from the Sumerian pottery, and it's a long way down the pike of evolution, it went through several changes before it got to this condition, this pottery must be a lot younger than the Sumerian pottery. It must have taken a long time for them to evolve that new style. 701 is too soon after 720 for all of those changes to have taken place. This level must be younger than 701. And so, because they know Nebuchadnezzar campaigned in the region in 597 B.C., they assigned a date of 597 to this level. Because on the basis of the pottery, it's so different from the Samaritan pottery, it must have taken a long time after 720 to evolve these new types. Okay, recently, archaeologists working at Lachish have confirmed, indubitably, this level is the 701 destruction. There's now no question of it. It is the 701 destruction. But then what does that tell us? The pottery in use in Lachish in 701 was completely different from the pottery in use in Samaria only 20 years before. They are practically contemporaneous cities. There's only a difference of 20 years between those two cities. Samaria destroyed 720, Lachish destroyed 701. Yet the pottery in use in those two places was totally different. So it shows you can't always rely on this assumption that pottery in use throughout the region is the same at the same time. Just because you find the same kind of pottery in two different cities doesn't mean you're dealing with the same time period. Doesn't always follow. Contrawise, just because you find two different kinds of pottery doesn't prohibit it being the same time period. You see, that's what this proved. Two totally different kinds of pottery, but essentially the same time period, despite the differences. And this is going to become critical when we analyze the evidence for the Israelite conquest of Canaan. Is we're going to see that the only way we can reconcile the biblical account and the archaeological material is to assume that certain cities in Canaan that were in existence at the same time were destroyed by Joshua when they were using different kinds of pottery. Just as the case of Lachish and Samaria. It's the only way possible, as far as I can see, that you can reconcile the biblical account with the archaeology. And it's the refusal of the archaeological community to accept that that makes it impossible for them to reconcile the Bible with the physical evidence, as far as Joshua's conquest is concerned. Now you say, well, wait a minute, why do they refuse? It was shown here to be true at Lachish, the two different kinds of pottery, same time. Why do they refuse? Because they say, just because the Bible insists we should assume it is not enough. The Bible is insufficient evidence. Here it was shown by the stratigraphy this had to be the answer, so we accept there had to be two different potteries. But unless you can show me physical evidence in the ground that they were simultaneous with two different types of pottery at the time of Joshua, I will not accept it. It's not proof enough just because the Bible says it had to be that way. You see? The Bible is not viewed as being especially authoritative. That's the problem. Okay.